I remember one spring that turned into instant summer. It was somewhere around late April. And we went from the normal spring temperatures to 26 to 30 degrees in the matter of a day. And that hung around for a few days. And during this window of summer, a buddy and I went canoeing. You know, it was a glorious day until about 1:30 or so, and the weather changed. Much like it changed yesterday, although more pronounced. By 3, it was snowing and ice was forming on the water. Getting out of the canoe, we got wet, and we still had to carry the canoe quite a distance before we got back to our vehicle. I remember trudging through farmer's fields in just a shirt. I had pants, too. But you know what I mean. I didn't have a coat. The hard, ice-like snow stinging my eyes and hurting my face as we walked into the wind. I'll never forget this. The bottom of my pants froze solid with ice before we got back to the car. My pant legs were as hard as a rock. What started out as a beautiful warm day became dark and cold and miserable, potentially life-threatening. And we weren't prepared to deal with it. This is kind of how I feel about where we're heading now in the next section of Romans. You know, when last we were in Romans, we enjoyed a nice, bright, warm, sunny day. The birds were singing. We could smell the flowers and feel the warmth of the sun on our faces. After all, where we left off was Paul declaring, "I'm not ashamed of the gospel because it's the power of God for salvation, for everyone who believes, first for the Jew, then for the Gentile. For in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last, just as is written, the righteous will live by faith." Never has there been sunnier words spoken. God revealed a righteousness that has been provided through Christ. A righteousness that we can have and we can hold on to by faith. It's a righteousness that's available to anyone and everyone who believes. And this righteousness allows us to know and to love and to serve and to be in relationship with our Creator. What more needs to be said? Lots, unfortunately. For example, why exactly is it that God has to supply a righteousness for us in the first place? What's wrong with our own righteousness? That's the question that Paul now turns to. And the skies are about to get very dark. And the snow is about to fly. You might actually want to put your coat on. Bill, put on your winter shorts, please. Please turn with me to Romans chapter 1, beginning at verse 18. It's on page 950. Romans chapter 1, beginning at verse 18, page 950. The blue Bibles underneath the chair in front of you, somewhere around you. Let me give you a bit of background. As I've already been hinting, verse 18 and what follows comes as quite a surprise. Kind of jumps out at us like a blizzard. Paul has just announced his theme for this letter, the gospel of God's saving power, revealing a righteousness that comes from him to all who believe. But instead of building on these wonderful truths, Paul switches gears. And we get this very dark section of Romans that goes all the way to verse 20 of chapter 3. After that, Paul will return to the theme of the gospel as he introduced it in verses 16 and 17. Why does Paul switch gears like this? It's because only by understanding how bad the bad news is can we fully appreciate how truly good the good news is. And the bad news is that everyone is sinful and deserving of God's wrath. This is what is proclaimed in this section of Romans. Paul begins with the sinfulness of the Gentiles in verse 18 through 32. And then he turns to the sinfulness of the Jews. Not sure that you're on the right slide. Might have to move forward, or maybe it's my mistake. Oop, yeah, okay, keep going. And sinfulness of the Jews. And finally, he concludes with the universal sinfulness of all mankind, or all humankind. And now when I say that 1:18 through 32 deals with the sinfulness of the Gentiles, what I mean is that this section really describes the entire world. It's just that it does it from a Jewish perspective, informed by God's Word. Now, before we embark on this cold, dark trip, we need to properly understand the big picture of the entire section, so as not to get confused or sidetracked. You know, first, we need to remember that the point of all of this is to remind everyone that no one can find the righteousness of God until they recognize the extent of their own wickedness, whether Jew or Gentile. Only then can they see the need to come to God in faith and experience His saving power and the righteousness that He provides. And what this means is that the purpose of Paul's writing of this section isn't to point out a particular group of people or a particular part of society or a certain lifestyle choice and talk about how nasty it is as opposed to how nice and good he is or Christians are. In other words, there's no contrast that Paul's making in this section, because before he's done in verse 20 of chapter 3, Paul will have argued that what he's described is the state of the human condition, period. The human condition outside of a trusting faith in the person and the work of Jesus Christ. In fact, there's a sense here that the Jewish people are the special focus of Paul in this section. What this means is that Paul spends more time and effort dealing with the sin problem related with the religious pride and the self-righteousness of the Jewish people than anything else. But that isn't because the religious self-righteous are worse than everyone else. It's just that this is part of his audience and a key issue in the church that he has to deal with before he can properly proclaim the good news of the gospel. Having said that, the point isn't that one group is worse than another. The point is, outside of the righteousness that God provides through Christ, we all stand knowingly and deservedly condemned. In this entire section that goes from chapter 1, verse 18, to chapter 3, verse 20, there is no us and them. There's no good guys or bad guys. We're all completely equal in our inability to stand before God in our own righteousness. Another thing to keep in mind is that Paul's talking about the world at large. He's speaking about it from a Jewish perspective, but nonetheless he's speaking about the general truth of the human condition in the broadest possible context. Paul's ultimate purpose is that this isn't to judge anyone or condemn everyone or point fingers at anyone. It's to show our need for a righteousness from God that is for everyone who believes. The purpose is to extend God's grace to all people, because God loves all people and wants to help rather than hinder. He wants to forgive rather than condemn. He wants to restore rather than reject. He wants us to live lives of joy, not confusion and division. As we get into the passage, let me just point out the connection and the logical progression between verses 17 and 18. Basically, it goes like this. God's saving righteousness is being revealed in the gospel by faith. And we really need God's saving righteousness, because God's wrath is being revealed against all people who have sinned against His glory. Beginning with verse 18, we read, "The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men, who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse." Let's stop there for now. We could spend the rest of our time just on these verses, but we're not going to because the snow's blowing and I'm getting cold. Let me just point out a few things, though, that we really need to see. First, I realize that we start to squirm when we hear the word wrath. The only wrath I'm comfortable with is the Wrath of Khan. It's one of my favorite movies. I've used that joke before, but it's a good joke in my opinion. Look at Captain Kirk. Maybe the show could have been called The Wrath of Kirk. I'm not sure. Some translations use the word anger rather than wrath because wrath is old-fashioned. But wrath is more correct. God's reaction to sin is not the anger of an emotional outburst or the vengeful intent of a hurt ego or damaged pride. It's the necessary reaction of a holy God to sin. God's holiness demands wrath against the sinner and mercy towards the repentant. You see, the characterization of the human condition isn't just that we have sinned or made a mistake or didn't know what we were doing. It's far worse than that. What is particularly important for Paul to emphasize in this passage is his insistence that God's wrath falls on people who suppress the truth. Think about it. You can't suppress the truth by accident. It's an act of the will, based on knowledge of the truth and a desire to hinder it by opposing it. Paul goes on to explain what he means by this in verse 19 and 20. "Since what may be known about God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse." Notice again Paul's emphasis on our guilt before God. We suppress the truth about God. God Himself has made the truth plain. We have clearly seen. We've understood. So that we're without excuse. And this has been going on since the creation of the world. This is our continuing reality. This is the air that we breathe. Now we should be careful here not to say more than Paul is saying. He admits that what has been made clear is God's invisible qualities, His internal power and His divine nature. So it isn't like Paul is saying that God sent everyone an email or that He's friended everyone on Facebook. There's an element of discernment that's required. There's an aspect of deduction that must take place. We see the truth of God's eternal power and divine nature, which is invisible, or which are invisible, by observing what has been made. But at the same time, God declares that we are without excuse because He's made the existence of His eternal power and divine nature plain, so it can be clearly seen. But the question must be then, if these invisible qualities are so clear, why is there such debate about the existence of God? It's because we've suppressed the truth. It's an interesting paper published in 2012 by David DePue and Bruce Weber in Biological Theory, which is a peer-reviewed scientific journal. The paper states, "We trace the history of the modern evolutionary synthesis and the genetic Darwinism generally, with a view of showing why, even in its current version, it can no longer serve as a general framework for evolutionary theory. The main reason is empirical. Genetic Darwinism cannot accommodate the role of development and of genes in development in many evolutionary processes. Notice the main reason. It's empirical. In other words, it's proven through collecting data on scientific experimentation and observation. Basically, the conclusion of the paper is that Darwinism can't explain how major forms of life evolved. Which doesn't mean they're throwing evolution out. Don't get them wrong. They're just saying the form of evolution that we have been following all this time can't be right. Now, this kind of thing is going on within the scientific community on a regular basis. And it may seem that, you know, the theory of evolution has a united front, but that's not the case at all. It's the elephant in the room that no one's talking about. You aren't going to hear scientists talking about this in school, though, because they're highly invested in suppressing the truth of God's eternal power and divine nature. Not specifically, not on purpose, but on principle. To put it another way, they're highly invested in a worldview that doesn't include the possibility of God. God showing up would ruin everything. There's been lots of science, lots of papers, which have questioned the assumptions, only to find them increasingly unsatisfactory. One of the most recent was published in the well-respected Atlantic magazine in the U.S. in this past September. Notice the tagline. We as a scientific community created an origin myth that has no more intellectual value than Genesis. This quote from a geologist at the University of California at Los Angeles by the name of Mark Harrison may not be particularly complimentary to Genesis, but don't miss his point. He goes on to say, although we're very quick to criticize those who operate on faith, that's exactly what we did. He's saying that given the most recent studies in geology, we really don't know how the earth came into being and what the earth was like in its early stages. I believe we're all born with an understanding of a creator God. It's very clearly displayed to us as we consider the night sky and the order and the systems that make up the world and the universe. You know, think of the Big Bang for a moment. Not the show, but the Bang. Scientists tell us that in one moment there was nothing, and then in the very next moment there was everything. Everything came out of nothing. From the largest galaxy to the smallest subatomic particle. How can we not believe? How can we not believe that there's a being beyond age and time, of infinite power, who is by necessity outside of creation, and who has brought everything out of nothing? There is no other solution in the scientific community. They just leave the question unanswered. When we're born, we default to seeing God in creation. Then we're taught to disbelieve. We're trained by those who suppress the truth to suppress the truth ourselves. Moving on, beginning with verse 21, Paul tells us why the world is without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified Him as God nor gave thanks to Him. But their thinking became futile, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools, and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal men and birds and animals and reptiles. Paul says that we knew God. What exactly did we know about God? When we talk about our knowledge of God based only on what we can gather from what has been made, our knowledge only goes so far. In order to really know God, we need a special revelation. We need His Word. But the point that Paul's making is that based on the truth that we did know about God, We weren't motivated in the least to worship Him. We had enough information to worship Him as our Creator. We had enough reason to give thanks to Him for life. But we chose not to. Thanksgiving is the appropriate response of anyone who realizes that their very life and experience of living is a gift from God. We didn't respond appropriately. You know, we didn't want to acknowledge our Creator because we didn't want to be reminded that we were created. We didn't want to acknowledge that life is a gift from God because then in some way we would owe God something. We much prefer feeling entitled over feeling thankful. Not that that makes us happy. The result of this lack of thankfulness in worship is that our thinking becomes futile. And our foolish hearts are darkened. The idea behind futile is that it's empty, it's worthless. The heart is the seat of the will. It includes our thinking and our attitudes. Paul describes their hearts as being empty of understanding. You know, they couldn't see things as they truly were. Then finally, they enter darkness. In other words, they reject the light of God. It's a scene in the fact that they claim to be wise, but they're actually foolish. The Greek behind the word foolish means to lack understanding. It kind of means to be stupid. It's the word for which we get moron. Stupid particularly when it comes to knowing how to live moral lives is the point. Arrogance always leads to ignorance. This isn't a comment on intelligence. It's a comment on attitude. A good definition of wisdom is that wisdom is knowing how to make the right choices and decisions based on available knowledge. That's knowing how to live. Those who reject God always think they're wise. In fact, it's their rejection of God that they point to as proof that they have superior wisdom. You know, they always think that they're wiser than believers. They consider believers to be naive and gullible and foolish and illogical and basically stupid. And they think of themselves as being sophisticated, unbiased, very intelligent, and guided by critical thinking. What they don't understand is that rejecting God is the opposite of wisdom. Think about it. Wisdom is based on making wise decisions. But the decision that's being made here is trading the immortal God, who is our only true source of wisdom and help, for idols that are images of mortal things. Not only have we exchanged the immortal for mortal, we've exchanged the truth for a lie, as it says in verse 25. We worship inanimate, impotent caricatures of weak mortal things. That doesn't seem wise to me. Why do we do it? If we worship what we create, if we worship our own image, or better yet, if we worship created things lower than our image, then we have the illusion of freedom to live lives on our own terms. We can worship whatever pleases us, whatever we desire, in whatever way we want to. We can focus on the most basic of our natures. But the problem is that we become very much like the God we worship. And when we worship ourselves, or our pleasures, or our desires, when we worship our ever-present idols of money, sex, and power, we have gods that shape us into their image. And we become less than we were created to be. We become inanimate, impotent caricatures of our true selves. In this passage, we have the first of three groupings of cause and effect relationship. The cause always begins with the word exchange. And then the result is always the same. Therefore, God gave them over. The idea behind God giving them over is how God's wrath is revealed in this present age. It doesn't suggest that God made them do these things. God didn't give them their desires. Rather, He gave them to what they desired, and the consequences of what they desired. All that was needed to destroy ourselves is for God to allow us to pursue our desires. It's a sobering thought. For those who exchanged the worship of the immortal God for the worship of idols, God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another. Idolatry always ends in immorality. Kind of begins there too. We become what we worship. If we lust after money, we lust more for more money. If we lust after pleasure, we can never get enough. If we lust after sex, our lust is never satisfied. Notice the phrase, the degrading of their bodies with one another. There's a sense here that when we refuse to worship our Creator, in whose image we are created, then the value and the respect for human life and dignity starts to go downhill. Life becomes cheap. Relationships become cheap. Disposable. Selfish. Sex becomes cheap. That's where wisdom leads. Our wisdom. Continuing on with verse 25. This brings us to our next exchange. Basically, it repeats verse 23. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator, who is forever praised. Amen. Notice, though, that Paul points out that we may try to free ourselves from worshipping God, but we always end up serving what we worship. Freedom's an illusion. We worship what we serve, even if we've created it. You know, we always serve something. But I love the end of this verse. It's a small clearing in the dark clouds that allow a shaft of light to pierce into this cold darkness. Paul stops for a moment and just jumps into spontaneous praise. He must acknowledge God and praise Him if he's going to get through the rest of the darkness. Because of a world that has exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped created things rather than the Creator, Paul says, God gave them over to shameful lusts. Even their women exchanged natural relations for unnatural ones. In the same way, the men also abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed with lust for one another. Men committed indecent acts with other men and received in themselves the due penalty for their perversion. Before we get into this section, note, first of all, that Paul's just indicated that the results of idolatry in verse 24 was that God gave them over to sinful desires and sexual immorality. The point being that our entire world is broken sexually. We're all broken. Promiscuity, divorce, pornography, adultery, on and on the list of sexual brokenness goes. There is no us and them in this passage. Paul is talking about all of us. He may be using a specific example here, but in this context, it's a context that applies to us all. There have been a lot of things written about these verses in recent years to somehow indicate that Paul isn't talking about just general homosexual activity. Some would say that he's talking about the acts of older men dominating younger boys, which was a common practice in the Greek-Roman world at that time. Or that he's talking about homosexual acts tied with idolatry or pagan worship. The idea behind such arguments is to equate the kind of behavior that Paul is talking about with some kind of behavior that we would still find inappropriate today, rather than homosexuality in general, which we don't seem to find inappropriate anymore. But the context doesn't allow this. First of all, Paul is clear that the sex is consensual here. It is lust for one another. If Paul wanted to indicate the dominance of a younger boy by an older man, if that was his intentions in talking about what he's talking about here, he could have used the appropriate word for boy, but he doesn't. He only uses the word for man. More than that, Paul mentions female homosexual activity, which was never part of temple worship or any forms of dominance, like male homosexuality often was. Others say this refers to those overtaken with sexual lusts of all kinds. In other words, this is referring to heterosexual men also pursuing homosexual interests because of an insatiable desire for sexual pleasure. This does a fair job of describing common sexual practices of many of the men in the Greek and Roman world. But this isn't the point that Paul's making. Before we go on, though, let's be honest here. Even though there are many instances of long-term homosexual relationships and even marriages in the Greek and Roman world, like, for example, Nero married two men along with his wives, this isn't exactly the same situation that we find ourselves in today. We must understand that this is a highly emotional issue that involves so much more than sexual activity. Now, being homosexual today is about community. It's about identity. It's about love. Furthermore, we also must understand that the church has been at worst hateful and at best awkward and unwelcoming when it comes to making meaningful connections and relationships with the homosexual community. But having said all that, the problem that Paul is pointing out is that the homosexual activity is unnatural, or more literally, contrary to nature. Notice I said activity here. Paul isn't talking about identity or desire. He's talking about activity. The context as he's been talking about has been the refusal to worship the Creator. And instead of worshiping the Creator, we worship things. We worship ourselves. We worship our own creations. The language of animals, birds, and creeping things in verse 23 echoes Genesis 1:30. The Greek in verse 23 mirrors the Greek version of Genesis 1:26, with both passages using identical words for image, likeness, man, birds, four-footed animals, and creeping things. The only conclusion that fits the parameters of Paul's words here is that Paul is framing homosexual behavior in the context of the Genesis account. And this is important for us to understand. Paul isn't just picking on homosexuality because it was prevalent in the Gentile world and basically unheard of in the Jewish world. And neither is he picking on homosexual behavior because it's the more sinful thing than anything else in this list. That's not the case at all. His reference to homosexual behavior is because it best illustrates the idea of throwing off any resemblance of a creator. You hear me? In other words, Paul is using the description of homosexual activity to show how the entire world system has suppressed the truth about God and refused to worship Him as creator. It's the best illustration he can come up with. You see, homosexual intimacy suggests that there's no divine design and no purpose for human sexuality. You know, to think that there is a purpose, that there's a design, is outdated and narrow-minded and bigoted. But it isn't. Paul's point is that male and female are complementary sexual expressions that God intended in His design and creation. Listen very carefully. The central issue in recent discussions of sexual choices, same-sex marriage, gender identity, and the pronouns, is who has the right to define me? Society's answer is not God, not other people, not even biology, only self. This is the very pathology that Paul is diagnosing in this passage. This is the very point he's trying to make. Moving on, we come to our last exchange, beginning with verse 28. Furthermore, since they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, He gave them over to depraved mind to do what ought not to be done. They have become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, and malice. They are gossips, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, and boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. The old evil just doesn't do it anymore. They disobey their parents. It should be at the top of the list. They're senseless, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Let's stop there. We obviously don't have time to investigate this list. Most of it's self-explanatory. Just note the quality of the list. It is full of attitudes and actions that destroy individuals, relationships, families, and communities. It describes a culture of people who care only about themselves and have no problem shaming and hurting and slandering and rebelling against everyone else. It's all about the promotion of self and the pursuit of self with no real thought for community or compassion or understanding. It is a testament to our times that we can no longer tolerate each other or even carry on important discussions on how to get along and understand one another or even talk about issues that affect us all. We only yell and hate and speak shameful, hurtful words, and that's how people get elected. Not that I'm referring to anybody in particular. The world we live in continues to grow into disconnected, self-serving, arrogant anger. We no longer acknowledge our Creator, and now we don't even acknowledge each other as human. We are caricatures with opposing views. Paul sums up everything with one last devastating comment. Although they know God's righteous decree, they know it, that those who do such things deserve death, they not only continue to do these very things, but they also approve of those who practice them. They propagate it. They promote it. They enlist. They evangelize in their creation of idols. Paul's point again is that we're without excuse. We know when something is wrong. We know when we are broken and sinful. But we continue to run away from God anyway. And then in order to deal with our guilt, we encourage everyone else to follow us. So we have company. Can you feel the snow on your face? Is it stinging yet? how cold and how dark it has become. But remember the point. Paul is showing us the darkness so that we'll turn to the light. God's present wrath isn't about rejoicing or isn't about rejecting us. It's about calling us. It's about Him saying, I have a solution to your brokenness and sin. I have light, hope, love, and a new identity for you. I sent my Son Jesus to make these things available to you. You just need to stop suppressing the truth and see it.